Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up in the next hour, we'll learn more about a Texas A&M study on public opinion about global warming. First, Ann and Carl Braden were considered national heroes in the fight for fair housing and against discrimination, and they called Louisville their home. While they had been fighting racial and social injustice together since they were married in 1948, it was their action in 1954 that put them in a different class altogether. In 1954, the Bradens purchased a home in an all-white neighborhood in Shively, Kentucky, and then by agreement sold it to the Wades, an African-American couple. Violence ensued, and Carl Braden served time for sedition, but the momentum was unstoppable. By 1968, the U.S. had a Federal Fair Housing Act that prohibited discrimination based on race. Robin Fisher spoke with local activist Susie Post about the Bradens, fair housing, and how we still have a long way to go for equality.
Let's start at the beginning and tell us a little bit about the 40th anniversary of the Fair Housing Act and about the act itself.
All right. First of all, your listeners and your audience needs to know that the Fair Housing Act established standards which penalize any entity, business, individual who did not rent or sell to a person on the basis of their race and their gender. Louisville went through a very serious struggle in order to get an ordinance enacted back in the 60s to make it illegal to do that here about the time that the Fair Housing Act was enacted. It has been amended, the Fair Housing Act, over the years to cover age, sexual orientation in the local one, marital status, disability, and I think I've covered all the bases, I hope. And any landlord or any realtor who discriminates against anyone falling into these categories is breaking federal and local law.
Now, you mentioned just a second ago about the local struggle. And locally, Ann and Carl Braden were the public figures of Louisville's fair housing movement. Tell us their story, because even if we've heard it before, it bears repeating.
Ann and Carl Braden were progressives who had a very heightened sense of justice and were working, each of them, for the Binghams, one at the, may it rest in peace, Louisville Times, and Carl on the staff of the Courier-Journal. They lived in the West End on Virginia Avenue, 4403 Virginia, and an African-American approached Carl and asked Carl if he would buy for him, the African-American, a house out in Shively, because that was an area where blacks did not live and probably would not be able to live. Carl went home and told his wife, Ann, that he had been approached with this request, and they both agreed that they had to do that. And so Ann and Carl bought a home on what is now Rome Court and then sold it to Andrew Wade, who had a wife and a daughter. Andrew Wade moved his family in, and within 2 weeks, the home was dynamited. And Ann and Carl were arrested and tried for sedition. And it's very important that we remember that this occurred at the tail end of the McCarthy period. And I bet at least half of your listeners don't know the American experience under Senator Joe McCarthy, who decided that he was going to raise his political opportunities by alleging communists in government. And a congressional committee, the House Un-American Activities Committee, was created. And all kinds of people were hauled before it and had to attest to their patriotism and were always asked, are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? And it was a period of enormous social unrest and hysteria. And when the house was bombed, the elected leadership, and I use that word very sarcastically, decided that they would take advantage of the of the anger in the United States and the fear. They played on people's fear. And they arrested Ann and Carl and tried them for sedition. Now, what is sedition? It's a law. It's a law that would prohibit trying to overthrow the country. Ann and Carl's sedition charge was trying to overthrow the government of Kentucky, which many years later it really strikes you as hysterically funny, but was deadly serious.
Now, the Supreme Court has overturned that, and there's no longer state sedition.
Right, right. I mean, it was unconstitutional on its face. However, Carl was in prison for a year, and when he was released after he served a year, neither Ann or Carl could find employment because they had a stain on their reputation. And eventually they went to work for a progressive civil rights organization called the Southern Conference Educational Fund, which ended up being located here in the Carl Braden Center at 32nd and Broadway. And that was how they got started, launched in terms of organized civil rights work, moving from newspaper work to civil rights work. And they had a tremendous influence on younger people and people like me who... I was an English major. The idea that you could bring someone forward and ask him, demand that he or she attest to their loyalty, it just made me crazy. So they had an impact in terms of working with a lot of younger people and with leadership in the black and white communities. Slowly, stain that the McCarthy years and that prison sentence had placed on them changed, but very, very slowly.
Well, you know, you talk about their impact on you on a personal level. And one thing that I thought was interesting in some of the material that I had was that you had said that you weren't in Louisville when this was happening. So tell us how you found out about what the Bradens were doing.
I was living in the Bay Area of California, finishing college. My father, who was a progressive, sent me newspaper clippings about the Braden trial. And I was absolutely horrified. And when I got back to Louisville, I decided that I would really like to meet them. And it took a few years before I did. And when I met them, it was in a church on Douglas Boulevard, where there was a meeting in order to organize to promote a movement here in Louisville for an open housing ordinance. And they were sitting in front of Ed and me at this meeting. And at the end of the talk, my husband stood up and asked, why couldn't we just use a straw man? Why do we have to go to all the trouble to enact an ordinance? And the speaker answered him, but this white-haired man in front of me scribbled something on a note, passed it over to Ed, and it said, talk to me later, Carl Braden. And so I'd been sitting behind Ann and Carl all this time and not even known it because I'd been so eager to meet her and her husband.
And we like to think that discrimination in housing is no longer an issue. But deep down, we know that's not true.
Oh, no, that's not true. Would that it were.
You have had some personal experiences with housing discrimination.
I have. They do make you feel kind of slimy. I belong to a religious minority. I'm Jewish. My husband and I at one point looked at a house off of Eastern Parkway that we could not possibly afford. This was back around 1963. And we went in. It was an incredible house. I mean, it just had everything. It had a fireplace in the master bedroom. It had a music room. It had floor-to-ceiling bookcases. But they wanted $50,000, and 30 was our top number. But we got in the car, and we fantasized, as young people do at that point, knowing that they can't possibly afford whatever it was they were looking at, whether it was a house, a chair, or a new pair of shoes. And we said, gee, it wouldn't be fun, but. And that was the end of it until the next day. And we had looked on a Sunday, which is traditionally a let's look at houses day. The next day, I was at home. I got a phone call from a woman who identified herself and asked me, wasn't I the Susie Post who had looked at the house off of Eastern Parkway the day before? And I said, I was. And she said, I just hate to tell you this, but there's a gentleman's agreement on this street that no one will sell to Jews. I don't remember my reaction, but immediately called my husband, who said without skipping a beat, we'll buy it. I said, we can't buy that. We can't afford it. He came home that night, and I thought, oh, my God, I think he's really serious. He said, we're going to buy that house. I said, but it's not near any of the things that our children need. It's not near their school. It's not near the Jewish Community Center. And I knew how stubborn he was and what an ego he had. And there's just no way that we could manage something like that. And he seemed to me to be pretty determined. When he went up into his office the next day in the Marion E. Taylor building, he bumped into a lawyer who he knew, and he went to talk to him, and the attorney said, no, there was no such thing. He thought that this was something that was cooked up by realtors to keep an area free of African Americans and Jews. So that was the first time. The time I think that struck me hardest was when my mother and father needed to move from their apartment into something more protective. And I took them out to look at a variety of assisted living places. This is when I was the ACLU director. One of the places we looked at was called The Forum. It was way out Shelbyville Road. Mother and Dad didn't particularly like it. So we went to look at a couple of others. And the next day, a gentleman calls me at work and said, Ms. Post, I understand that you brought your mom and dad out here yesterday to look at our facility. I said, yes. He said, well, I really hate to tell you this, but we cannot take them. I said, why not? He said, well, your father is so disabled. We have an agreement that we will not accept people with significant disabilities because the residents find it depressing. Clunk. So I said, that is unconstitutional. I will talk to my lawyer. The next day I got a call telling me that they had everything under, you know, they had all the papers I needed to sign. Come on out and sign them. So, of course, I didn't. But it just, it's mind-blowing when things like that happen to you. When I went to my closing for the house that I now live on in 22 years ago, I saw the deed for the first time. And as I'm thumbing through it, I come to this phrase that says that this house may not be sold to anyone of the Negro race or the Jewish persuasion. I said, what is that? And my attorney said, oh, don't worry about that. That doesn't apply anymore. I said, that is unconstitutional. So those were my three experiences personally with housing discrimination. And I think that folks who've never experienced discrimination of any kind do not understand how powerful those kinds of experiences can be. Unless you have an enormous amount of strength, they can just destroy your sense of self. It didn't touch me, but other people aren't quite as strong as I am. It makes you feel dirty. It makes you feel dirty for what other people are doing.
And what's interesting about it, and I've heard this from other people too, is, you know, your experience with these people called you sort of on the sly to tell you what was going on, as if you would understand and then that would make it okay.
Right. Oh, that's all right. Just bigotry.
It's like, okay, well, then I won't put my parents
nothing
there.
But racism.
So
what's a little anti-Semitism among friends?
It is. It's sort of that attitude.
Yeah, it is.
You know, that oh, you'll understand.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that your experience with your parents was much later, much more recent
yes.
than the 1960s.
Yes, it was. It was about 18 years, 17 years ago. And it was doubly painful to me because my father had been a very strong, vigorous man who was on doctor's orders walking 3 miles every day, and while doing so in Florida, was hit from behind by an 85-year-old woman and thrown a couple hundred yards, and was in a coma for 2 weeks and never regained full mobility. And he went almost overnight from being a strong, vigorous, vital human being into being someone who suffered for the rest of his life with pain. And to have that told to me by an assisted living center manager, it was like, you know, poor dad, he's got to live with this day after day, and they don't want to look at him because it's depressing.
Carl Braden died in 1975, and Ann continued the fight until she passed in 2006.
Correct.
Do you think that she was as influential on her own as they were together?
I think that Carl gave Ann some balance in her life. While he was alive, they would take vacations every August up east at a friend's place. While he was alive, I think that he would dissuade her from going overboard on certain concerns. And I think after his death, I think she grieved for a very, very long time. And I don't think that any one of us could sort of pull her back. She would go out on a limb and a lot of times, you know, with very little to go out there for, if she thought that it was the right place for her to be. However, I think that she continued to be an extremely effective civil rights advocate. She was a beautiful writer, and she published after their experience with the White House a book called The Wall Between, about racism and how this wall of racism separates us. And she continued to write for the Southern Christians Leadership Conference and for all kinds of local organizations. She started another organization, the Southern Organizing Committee. She poured all of her energy into those movements. When Jimmy Carter gave money for the International Women's Year conference in Houston back in the 70s, she was out there, and she continued to write and document what kinds of things were going on in the nation and in the Louisville community particularly that were unjust.
Well, I do know that she would call me from time to time.
Yep, I'm not a bit surprised. To correct you or to ask for something?
Well, I was usually to either correct me or to say she had heard her name that had come up on the radio and wanted to know in what context.
Yep.
So she was a
good
fighter up
she
to
was.
The end.
She really, really was. She's just... And she was my fact checker. I mean, she was really important, played an important role for me in terms of her analysis. Sometimes I didn't see some of the things that she saw. And in explaining to me what it really was, I learned. And she was just an enormous person in my life. And I have and will always have enormous admiration for both of them.
Now, there's going to be an event commemorating the Bradens on April 11th.
That's correct. Her son, Jimmy, who lives in California, put the house that he grew up in on Virginia for sale about a year and some months ago. And we decided, the Metropolitan Housing Coalition decided, that it would be really appropriate for us to take some kind of action in regards to the sale of that house. So we called some people, and they got together to figure out, one, could that house be bought and serve as a repository for some fringy civil rights groups? Could it be maintained in that way? And finally came the conclusion that the best solution, because none of us wanted to be involved in becoming landlords, that the best solution was to have a Kentucky historical marker placed in front of that house, and that is going to be unveiled on Friday, April the 11th at 11 o'clock, and I hope your viewers will come. It's going to be a really fascinating and moving event to bring to some real final conclusion the lives of Ann and Carl Braden and the impact that they've had on our community.
Thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher with local social activist Susie Post. Post talked about early civil rights activist Ann and Carl Braden. To commemorate the Bradens' work and the 40th anniversary of the Fair Housing Act, an historical marker will be placed at the Bradens' former home at 4403 Virginia Avenue Friday morning at 11. More information is available at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, more on how the country views global warming. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Stephanie Sanders talks to CBS national correspondent Byron Pitts about his early struggles with literacy. But first, political scientists at Texas A&M University have published the results of a public opinion poll on global warming. Their study examines a respondent's knowledge of global warming, along with information about demographics and ideology, and then correlates that with a sense of personal responsibility for tackling the problem. They thought they'd find the relationship to be pretty simple. The more you know, the more concerned you are. But as WFPL's Kristen Espelon found during her conversation with the study's lead author, Paul Kelstedt, the results took them by surprise. Kelstedt says he and his colleagues embarked on the study not only because very little had been done to study public opinion about global warming, but also very little had been done to find out how that opinion is influenced by the media.
We were particularly interested in the role that information plays about policy attitudes, and especially about the risk assessments about global warming and climate change, because information about global warming and climate change is really becoming much more of a mainstream thing. Even 6 or 7 years ago, I don't think most Americans really even knew what global warming and climate change was. Certainly, there are no public opinion studies that are that old about it. And so as information became more prevalent, even down to things like, you know, movies like Ice Age and Ice Age 2 that my children watch, it was sort of seemed like a natural gap in the literature to see what role information played in sort of informing people's assessments of the risks and their own sort of responsibility for global warming.
And so I understand that you expected, as I would have expected, and anybody, I think, that the more information is out there, and certainly the more consensus among scientists about the threats of global warming and what's causing it, you'd expect a certain set of results, right?
Exactly. We expected, sort of consistent with what's sort of called the knowledge deficit model in sort of technical jargon, that as the experts, you know, sort of developed a consensus, as they really have on global warming and climate change, that as they sort of promulgated their results and as they became more, you know, widely known, and as images of ice shelves falling off of Antarctica and into the oceans become more and more prevalent, that it would raise concerns about it. And what we found was exactly the opposite, that the more sort of self-reported information people had about global warming and climate change, the less personally responsible they feel for it, and in addition, the more information they have, the less concerned they feel about it, the less risky they think it is for them and their families.
And you also uncovered some other surprising results, namely that the demographic that is expressed the most concern about the risk of global warming wasn't who you expected it to be at all.
Right, but those results, the white male effect that we discovered, is not nearly as unusual as you might have thought, because those effects really only appear after controlling for all the other demographic and attitudinal variables that you see there. So it's not necessarily the case that men as a whole are massively concerned about global warming and climate change. And indeed, those effects that we find in the study are not huge, but they only appear in sort of the multivariate statistical models that we build, and they're not quite as there's nothing necessarily about being male that makes people more concerned about it. It's really more of a function of some of the other demographic forces in their model.
Well, let's talk about some of the forces you were looking at. Can you walk me through the survey itself, how you conducted it, what kinds of questions you asked, and a little bit about the demographic diversity of the sample?
Sure. First, it was a telephone sample of a little over 1,000 Americans done by random digit dialing. And so the nice thing about this is that our survey is a representative sample. It is a random slice of American adults, and so we can, with some degree of confidence, say that the results that we find generalize quite effectively to the entire population as a whole, sort of like any other genuinely random sample, and this was that. We asked a lot of questions about people's values in particular. One of the biggest driving forces in the public opinion literature on the environment is this thing called the new environmentalism paradigm, which really talks about people's sort of instinctive orientations toward sort of protecting Mother Earth, and about sort of humanity's interaction with the Earth and with the planet as a whole, something that's much more broad than any attitudes about climate change and includes all kinds of things really involving sort of the role that people play on the Earth in general. And that variable, quite as predicted, showed to be a very, very large and significant effect on people's concerns about global warming and climate change. So that people who embraced this new environmentalism paradigm were much more likely to be personally responsible for global warming, to feel personally responsible for it, and also to express concern about global warming and climate change.
So in other words, the more you care about the Earth, have a connection to nature, the more likely you are to feel a level of personal responsibility when it comes to addressing climate change?
Absolutely. And that variable, more than any of the other ones in our model, was sort of the big engine that drives the model. And that result is something that confirms things that were in the literature. And our effects that we find on information were the sort of the new wrinkle in studies, the new wrinkle in the literature that we're adding.
Did your results show any connection between, let's say, gender or age and a person's connection to nature, their feeling for the Earth and their role in caring for it?
We did find a connection with age in particular that we haven't discussed yet, which is that people who are younger felt much more of a connection, both in terms of responsibility and concern about global warming and climate change, because presumably, I mean, we don't know the exact reason for this, but we assume that the mechanism behind that is that younger people are going to be on the planet longer, and they're much more aware that, you know, hey, if they're going to be around for another 70 or 80 years, the risks of catastrophic things happening to them are much higher than for people in their 70s or thereabouts.
And let's just revisit the overall results, the general results you got once again. The headline I read from it is, you know, the more you know about global warming, the less you care about it.
Yeah, that's true. The more information that people report they have about global warming and climate change, the less personally responsible they feel for it, and also the more information they have, the less they feel concerned about it, the less risky they think global warming and climate change is in terms of affecting their life and their family's life in the future.
So I got to ask, what do you make of that?
Well, I make a lot out of that. There's a lot of room for speculation here. And in particular, I think that it suggests that people who are sounding the alarms about global warming and climate change need to do some thinking about how their public relations is working. And I know that they're well-meaning people who are trying to educate the public. It's possible, though, that their education efforts aren't having quite the traction that they need them to have. It's also worth noting that our study was done in 2004, which is before Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, and before Al Gore's movie An Inconvenient Truth. And so we do plan on doing follow-up studies of this, of course, I mean, in particular in light of the hurricanes that happened, and brought a lot of attention on, you know, was there a role of global warming and climate change in the size and the strength and the ferocity of those storms. So It's possible that, in fact, even in the 4 years, or 3.5 years since we did this study, that things may have changed, and that the balance of sort of stories and media messages out there about global warming and climate change are having different effects on opinion than they were just a few years ago.
I've been speaking with Paul Kelstedt from Texas A&M University. Thanks very much, Paul.
Glad to be with you.
You can read Kelstedt's study on our website, WFPL.org. Byron Pitts has covered some of the biggest stories of our time. He was at Ground Zero on 9/11. He was embedded with U.S. Armed Forces when they went into Iraq, and he was nearby when the statue of Saddam Hussein was torn down. Now he's national correspondent for CBS News, a job that requires him to communicate complicated stories effectively in a short amount of time, utilizing his communication skills. It would be hard for a viewer to guess that when Byron Pitts was 12 years old, doctors had classified him as functionally mentally disabled and advised his mother not to expect much accomplishment from her son. But Pitts wasn't disabled. He couldn't read. He was the keynote speaker at last week's National Conference on Family Literacy in Louisville and shared his experience with Stephanie Sanders.
What do you think are some of the misconceptions about people who can't read?
Great question. I think some are that they're lazy, that they're ignorant, that they're incapable of learning. And that may well be the case in some instances, but speaking for myself and people who I know, that there is a huge distance between being illiterate and being someone unable or unwilling to learn. I mean, if you look certainly at our country now, with the sizable number of immigrants who come to our country who don't speak English, who therefore they can't read English. It's not that they're not intelligent, they're not bright, but they've not had the resources to learn how to read. My own situation, I mean, growing up in an urban environment, raised by a single parent, it becomes easy enough for people to cast you aside, to assume certain things. I was someone who either benefited or was victimized by social promotion before it had a name, that people sort of pushed me through school just because that it felt like being bothered or didn't think, you know, I could be helped. But I think, I mean, one of the things that I believe about people who are now in situations that I was once in, that if you are illiterate, here's what it says to me, that you're someone who lives in the dark, that you're someone who, certainly if you're an adult who is illiterate, you are someone who's learned to be creative, that you're able to still function in a society where 75% of all jobs require basic reading skills. You're someone who's managed to get by being unable to read. So that tells me you're creative. It takes some level of resilience to be able to wake up in the morning and face this unkind world and not be able to read. So it seems to me that any company in our country wants people who are resilient and people who are creative. And I think for many of the people who battle with illiteracy, if you can teach them that one thing, they can be productive citizens, they can be productive employees, and they can contribute well to our society. I'm a witness.
Do you think most Americans understand how big the problem of illiteracy is in our country?
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, they say, like, you know, we all have a cousin or uncle or someone we know. I think so. I mean, I was in Palm Beach County, Florida last week, West Palm Beach, one of the richest counties in all the United States. You know, some of the prettiest, richest people in America live in Palm Beach County. But estimates are at least 100,000 people there in that county can't read. Well, you multiply that by every county across the country, and the numbers are probably higher in poorer communities. So it is a problem. Now, we are a nation with a host of problems, but I'd argue that if we can do a better job of addressing illiteracy, we can solve some of our problems. There have also been studies that have shown that 75% of the young men who've returned to prison have issues with literacy. So if you teach them to read, how many of those young men wouldn't be in prison? I know oftentimes when I travel as a journalist, you know, we spend a lot of time as journalists going to bad neighborhoods where bad things have happened. And so many times I say to myself, therefore for the grace of God go I. But I remember there was one therapist who told my mother, well, let's just wait and see what happens, and we'll revisit this when he turns 15. My mother said, by the time he's 15, he'll either be dead or he'll be in prison. My mother was smart enough to know she didn't have 3 years to wait for me to get help. So what happens to those kids who don't have a mother like mine, didn't have the resources that she was able to come up with to get help? Well, either they turn to crime, they turn to other things that are less productive with their lives. So I think it is a problem for our country. Do I think it's in the top 5? Maybe. Top 20? Probably. That I think that we are a wonderful nation. We have smart people. I mean, we're capable of chewing gum and walking at the same time. That I think we can tackle a host of these issues at the same time. You know, one of the good things about the National Center for Family Literacy, it's something these people have committed their professional lives to dealing with. And so with organizations like that, again, I'm an optimist, so I think the future
is
bright.
Is it something that, as you've mentioned, it seems like it's more of an individual thing to be solved? You mentioned, you know, for people who don't have a mother like you or don't have the determination that you have maybe, or maybe don't even realize how big of a problem it is and how it's affecting their life. What can be done on a grander level, on a state or on a national level, to help people like that?
Well, the short answer is I don't know. And that's one of the great things about the National Center for Family Literacy. I mean, these people devote their careers and their time to solving that issue. But I would think that it seems to me it is a significant enough issue that we have to address it as a country, that it's in our own best interest to figure out solutions. And I don't necessarily think it is an individual problem, but it certainly plagues communities. I met a woman when I was in West Palm Beach last week. She's a Haitian immigrant. She has 3 kids, a single parent. Well, she now is just learning to read herself. She's now about to get her GED. She hopes going to college. Well, as a college-educated woman, she can provide a better life for her 3 children. Well, those 3 children, if they see that their mother reads and she reads to them, there's a better chance they'll become readers. There's a better chance those 3 people will go on to college. Okay, once they're in college, their ability to make a good living increases. Well, let's say they go on to, like, their postgraduate degree. That increases the chance that they can get better jobs. And if they go to college, they all have kids. Let's say each of them has 2 kids. So that's now, what, 6 more people in our country who are better equipped to face the world. So I don't think it's an individual. I mean, I think it is. Certainly, I think it harms the individual. But I think it hurts us as a nation, this issue of illiteracy.
Are there signs that, because we've talked a little bit about how it's easy to assume that the person isn't smart or the person isn't hardworking, are there signs that we can look for to maybe realize if there's someone in our lives who can't read and we just don't know it and they're embarrassed to share it?
Another good question. I remember I had a friend, and one of the things I think that is, if not unique to the issues of illiteracy, something that's common. There is no quick fix. Like, you can't help someone on Monday and by Friday, problem solved, let's move on to something else, the global warming or something. You know, I mean, it is a lifelong issue. I was diagnosed when I was 12 as being functionally illiterate. When I was a freshman in college, I was 17 years old. A dear friend of mine, one of my roommates, a guy named Peter Holthy from Minnetonka, Minnesota, the whitest white guy I'd ever met at that point in my life. And Pete came up to me as this very awkward, you know, freshman, 17-year-old to 17-year-old, and said, Byron, why is your vocabulary so limited? I mean, as a freshman in college, you should use bigger words than you're using. Well, that was pretty bold of him to say, and I'm sure it took courage for him to say that. Well, as a result, for the next 4 years, every day we were in college, Pete gave me a new word in the dictionary, and I had to define it, spell it, and use it in a sentence. So here's a guy who stepped out and had the courage to speak up and had the compassion to care about someone else to help me out. And that helped me help me address my issue. So I would think if we just did that, and all of us know people in our world who struggle in some way, and I guess sort of ask them, you know, how you can help them. nudge them perhaps in the right direction. I think, you know, I'm a parent now. I have children. I'm involved in the school system where they are. I know in the town I live in, there's this whole group of kids. They're called the Basement Boys. These are the young men who take the basement classes, who are directed towards shop and are directed away from college. And I would think within that group, there are a number of young men and young women who have the intellect to become good readers and stronger students if someone took interest in them. So I think whether it's involvement in the school, involvement in your church, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, there are opportunities to reach and to help people. If you're an employer and trying to make your workforce more productive, if you see people who struggle with literacy, to offer them assistance. Not because it's a nice thing to do, not because it makes you feel good, but it improves, I think, the quality of your workers because it will improve the quality of that person's life.
So mostly on the part of the person who can't read and on the part of people who are part of that person's life, it's mostly about overcoming the embarrassment of it and having the courage to talk about it.
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think on the part of the individual, I think it requires courage. I think on the part of the large group, the institution, it takes conviction that you have to be willing to put your time and your money and your resources into improving the reading skill level of the people around you. I think it takes effort on both parts. But I certainly think for the individual, it's finally being willing to say out loud that I can't read and I need help. I remember that moment for me and how painful it was. But I also remember about 18 months later, I brought a note home from school. And for the first time in my life, I read that note out loud to my mother as opposed to handing it to her. And my mama cried. I cried. But it was a joyous occasion. It was a joyous occasion. And so now I look back, I'm 47 years old. I've interviewed the last six presidents of the United States. I've won my share of national awards. I've seen much of the world. But still one of the proudest moments in my life, next to the birth of my children, was when I read that note to my mother, that that we proved together that I wasn't dumb, but I was someone who needed help. I was getting the help I needed. And, you know, I was on my way.
That was Stephanie Sanders talking with Byron Pitts, who overcame a learning disability and is now CBS News national correspondent. You can learn more about Byron Pitts and how you can spot signs of illiteracy among those in your life at WFPL.org. When we come back, Elizabeth Kramer has more on National Poetry Month. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. In 1996, then-President Bill Clinton officially recognized April as National Poetry Month. This year, in Louisville, Spalding University and a small press is launching Thousand Poets, a month-long celebration of poetry with readings throughout the community. WFPL's Elizabeth Kramer reports.
Thursday was the beginning of Thousand Poets, with the first event of more than 20 for this month-long festival of poetry in Louisville. There will be poetry readings at galleries and art museums, at coffee houses and bars, and at libraries and schools. During the festival's first event, students at Manual High School read to nearly 100 others in the school's auditorium.
It felt like Thursday at mid-afternoon. Slight anticipation lingered inside. Anxious for meeting never too soon.
You see, he and I have similar situations. No one told us what to fight for. Dice and guns. 4 o'clock in the morning looking at video whores.
Golden sky, violet redstone, orange water, candy for my eyes. All this as the sun sank behind distant mountains. Light faded with heaven, and I awoke from my sleep.
Thousand Poets is the brainchild of two poets. One is Merle Bachman, who runs the undergraduate creative writing program at Spalding University. The other is Jessica Farquhar, who runs Well Lit Press, a company that publishes broadsides and chapbooks of poetry. I sat down with Merle Bachman to find out the origin of the festival and what it entails.
How did this idea of doing a month of all this poetry emerge?
I ran into Jessica at a poetry reading in the fall, And we were just catching up and talking about poetry and whatnot. And she mentioned the idea of a poetry festival. And I just thought, yes! I had this vision of this, you know, taking National Poetry Month and doing a bunch of events that would take us into the community that wouldn't be tied to a particular campus. And Jessica was really into it, so we took off.
Taking off entailed what exactly in terms of getting the people and the logistics together?
In the beginning, it was just kind of dreaming stuff up. I mean, just like, well, why don't we do this? And how about if we do that? And then kind of creating this vision. Later, then we had to, you know, track down the people who would hopefully be involved and get the venues to agree and all of that. So, I mean, most people, once they heard about it, they wanted to take part.
What are some of the most unusual venues for poetry readings on the schedule?
We're going to have poetry in the galleries at the Speed Art Museum on Friday, April 25th. And we'll be doing a Best Loved or Beloved poetry event at Ray's Monkey House on Bardstown Road on Wednesday, April 16th.
What type of poets and poetry can people come to hear?
And in terms of the styles, I'm going to be interested to see because there's some poets who are reading who, you know, I've seen some of their work, but I've never heard them read or I don't know them that well, but they seem, you know, like perfectly fine poets. I think there's going to be a lot of variety in the styles. I think the reading of beloved poems is going to be fun on the 16th because some of us who are reading are poets and some are not, and they're just reading their favorite poems. So we have a variety of readers.
What is that event actually, and how many people will be reading? What do you mean by beloved poems?
One of the emphases of Thousand Poets with asking all these different poets to read has been to invite poets to read not just their own work, but to tap into the universe of poetry because we're interested in introducing people to what's out there in poetry. I mean, every poet is very fond of their own work, but there's just so many wonderful poets out there. And that's, in fact, one reason why we're kicking off the festival with everyone reading from Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass.
Why that text?
Well, we look at Walt Whitman as kind of like the great gray father of American poetry, and he's associated with the broad embrace, the completely democratic approach. I mean, he includes everyone in his poetry.
People used to memorize poetry, and people knew poets. Even in the 60s, everyone knew who Robert Frost was. Now, you know, it's changed. What do you think is the role of poetry in modern society, and how do you think this festival can address that?
Well, big question. One of our images for the festival is every citizen a poet. In fact, Jessica's been making some buttons that say citizen poet. And the notion is that at least for the month of April, everyone gets a chance to kind of contact their inner poet. The belief is that poetry is really a special form of expression that privileges not just the emotions, but it gives everyone a chance to really speak to what's the most important to them about not only their life, but life itself. And it's true, poetry has receded in importance in various curricula. But on the other hand, it's kind of making a comeback across the U.S. There are more and more spoken word evenings and poetry jams. There is an incredible proliferation of MFA programs and creative writing. There's just been a lot more attention, I think, focused on poetry as, yes, I mean, this is something we have available to us in our culture.
Thousand Poets continues through the end of April. A calendar of the events is on thousandpoets.org. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.